Learn how to value your early stage startup with Bob Chung.
Good morning. I appreciate everybody taking time out from a post-holiday hangover and coming out here for a little talk about valuation, which I'm a bit of a nerd, okay, so it's exciting for me. Puts other people to sleep sometimes, but that's the way it is. So we're going to talk a little bit about valuation. I'm going to start with at a very basic level. First, talk in very broad terms about the traditional valuation methodologies, asset approach, market approach, income approach. And then we'll dig into a little bit further detail about the fundraising process for entrepreneurs, a little bit of on why we do valuations, things like that. Okay, so the first thing that I just want to impress upon you is that get rid of any notion that there's any such thing as an objective valuation. Okay, just forget about it. There's no such thing. Valuation is subjective. It depends on the point of view and the perspective of who's doing the valuation and who is being presented with the valuation. Okay, as I said, there are historically been three traditional approaches to valuation: asset approach, market approach, income approach. In broad terms, you can think of it, and you know, the words are may seem a little bit nebulous. To kind of bring it to a more practical perspective, something that people might understand, think of it in terms of your house, okay? Cost, the asset approach or is basically the cost approach, and that's essentially you're going to value the house based on how much it's going to take for you to build it. Okay, if you've got a plot of land, how much did the plot of land cost you? How much is it going to cost for you to go out and acquire the materials, acquire contractors, et cetera, and then have them actually put together the house? All right. So it's very much of a baseline value for any asset. And quite frankly, it's not all that useful in everyday life as far as businesses go. Okay. Because think about it. If you value a business based on just as a collection of assets, what value have you really created? What leverage have you created? Okay. So it's really a floor or minimum value. So the asset approach looks at the value of an enterprise as roughly the equivalent of the value of its assets, less its liabilities. So there are a couple of different types of costs that you could take the perspective on. Replacement costs, reproduction costs. Replacement is exactly what it sounds like, how much would it cost to replace a group of assets. Reproduction costs is a little bit more sophisticated than that. You're really looking at how much does it cost to reproduce the functionality of a group of assets. And that takes into account things like depreciation, economic obsolescence, things like that. It's really most useful when applied to companies with significant capital assets. Typically, it's really used for really, really early stage companies that haven't had an opportunity to either, as I mentioned, to create value or even perhaps to have any real semblance of a business plan. Okay. Again, so it's really useful in a very, very limited number of circumstances. However, one useful thing about the cost approach is that it's a reality check. Okay, if you do all your different types of analyses using the other traditional approaches and you come up with a value answer that's less than what it's going to cost for you to gather those assets together and put them in place, then why bother? Okay, well, like I said, it's not all that useful. So that's the asset approach. Next is a market approach, and this is going back to my house example. This is more akin to when you're ready to sell your house. What do? Okay, first thing you do is you go out and you go on Zillow or something like that, and you see what similar houses in your neighborhood have sold for, okay? And that gives you some kind of a reasonable semblance of an idea of what your house is worth. But you also take into consideration differences between your particular house and the house that sold that across the street, next block over, maybe three blocks over, something like that. There could be differences in terms of the size of the garage, number of bedrooms, number of bathrooms, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. But the transaction gives you a basic idea of what your house is worth. Okay. So it's a relative approach to valuation. Ideally, you would look at direct comparisons to other enterprises and their equity securities. With companies, instead of looking at number of bedrooms, number of bathrooms, et cetera, right? You look at valuation multiples, basically based on financial metrics. Okay. I know that with a lot of companies, there may not be a whole lot of financial metrics to look at. So you default to other metrics, user engagement, number of page views, number of regular monthly users, et cetera, okay? Assuming that you've generated sufficient traction, all right? But those are sort of defaults. Ideally, at the end of the day, I hate to say it, we're in business to make money. And so because of that, financial metrics really matter more, at least to me, all right? And I know I'm kind of talking like an old industry guy, which I have to admit I kind of am. But you try to measure the company and how it's performing as best you can, all right? There are a couple of different types of comparisons that you could do, types of indications. You can look at publicly traded companies. These are the big, roughly comparable companies that you can identify that are publicly traded, still trading out there. Very easy to pull their stock prices from the Wall Street Journal or Yahoo Finance or whatever. And you can download their filings from the SEC and compute multiples. All right. The thing to keep in mind is that the unit that these companies are trading is one share of stock, which is a minority interest. And if you're trying to value a company, you're typically trying to value 100% of a company, that's a controlling interest. So you might want to take into consideration adding a little bit of a control premium on top of the public market value to consider the fact that you're looking at a minority versus having control of the company. That said, there are other offsetting adjustments that you need to make to value, right? Things like liquidity, public versus private, okay? Growth rates. Typically, public companies are pretty well established and they're big, right? They've been around for a long time. And just because of the size of their revenue, it's not going to grow that quickly. It's really, really hard to grow a company from $5 billion to $6 billion than it is to grow a company from $10,000 to $100,000. And so you have to take that into consideration when you take a look at things like multiples. Okay. And frankly, the market right now out there is very, very much paying for that growth, particularly in a economy that's stagnating a little bit. All right. The other thing to take a look at are precedent M&A transactions. Okay. Effectively, the market for corporations. Okay. A company gets bought or sold. At what price did that transaction happen? And relative to the financial metrics of the target company, how much was paid for each dollar of earnings or each dollar of revenues that target company generated? Okay. And you can take that metric and again, somehow apply it to subject company. That, of course, assumes that you're able to get that information, which can be a bit of a challenge, especially if you're talking about a private company buying another private company. They have no obligation to disclose that information really to anybody. You're in a better shape if you are talking about a public to private transaction, because the public company needs to disclose that information for its SEC filings. You're in really good shape if you're talking about acquiring a public, right? Because all that information has already been disclosed. But the downside of doing that is that you're typically talking about a much bigger company, much bigger transaction. And realistically, how applicable is that really to your specific startup company? But again, you're looking at guidelines. You're looking for something to give you a little bit of a foundation to do other analyses. And the fact that it's an actual transaction means that the information isn't bad and it's absolutely relevant, right? I use research analyst reports quite a bit. And these are things that are published by people who follow those companies on an everyday basis. And so it's not a bad source of information. The thing you have to keep in mind, however, is that to a certain extent, the research analysts are dependent on the companies that they cover to provide them with information. Okay. And so there may be some inherent amount of bias in what they write and how they interpret the data. Always try and support any analysis that you do with as much data as you can. And be creative in terms of interpreting your data. Okay. There are other places. I think CB Insights is a great one. I don't really mean to do a plug for them, but there you are. The other indication of value is our prior transactions in the company's own securities. This is particularly true for venture-backed startup companies. Okay. The thing that you have to be careful of, it's fine if you can find transactions in a company's own securities that are identical to the securities you're trying to value. So for example, common versus common. If you're trying to value the common of startup A, and there's been, you can find information on a transaction where somebody sold that company's common stock, then that's perfect. What you have to be careful about is what's so very often true in the Valley is that VCs won't invest in common. Okay. They will invest in preferred securities, which gives them certain preferential rights and privileges over and above the common. And those rights and privileges, despite what the VCs tell you, those rights and privileges do have some value. All right. And if you ever have that conversation with a VC, a really interesting question to pose to them is, if they try to tell you that those rights and preferences don't have any value, then ask them, then how come you're not investing in common? So there is some inherent value there. So you have to be careful. If you can find information on a transaction in company A's, let's say preferred A round or B round or even preferred seed securities, well, how much of an indicator of value really is that to you if you're holding common or if you're trying to value the common? Okay. And does that make a difference in the overall implied value of the company overall? And to me, the answer to that question is yes, obviously. Okay. Some people will tell you otherwise, but I do happen to believe that there's value. So the primary issues with this approach is kind of touched upon this. How do you select the appropriate comparables? What really defines comparability? Okay. And especially for those of you who are doing things in innovative technologies or biotech or something like that, your whole reason for being is you're trying to do something that nobody else has done, okay? Well, you're trying to build something that nobody else out there has yet. And so because of that, is there anything that's truly comparable? Think about that. That's something that you need to consider when you select your list of, quote, comparable companies to take a look at. And generally speaking, what I always tell people is, yeah, okay, fine. The reality is that there's no two companies out there ever that have been exactly alike, okay? But again, the reason that this method came into being is that you need some kind of guidepost. So you do the best that you can to try and identify what are the factors that are most driving the economics of the company and the opportunity. Okay? So I spent a lot of time early in my career working in emerging markets, working in Eastern Europe, actually, right after the Berlin Wall came down. And looking at a lot of companies there, it was very clear that the main drivers for the economics of those companies weren't the fundamental operations of the company. It wasn't what they did, because they're all state-owned monopolies. All right. What was driving the value is the fact that they're freaking located in Romania, all right, or Bulgaria or wherever. Okay. And so I had no problems doing comparable company analysis, looking at Hungarian pharmaceutical company and using that to compare it to a Hungarian electronics distributor, okay? Because at the end of the day, you're really referencing the value of the Hungarian economy, which is driving the economics of those firms, rather than what they did. I think probably the most enjoyable projects I had while I was working out there was when I worked with the Hungarian state-owned ice cream manufacturer and the Hungarian state-owned wine company. So that was a whole lot of fun, especially when the managing director of the wine company kind of forced us into a cellars and had us sample his new vintage of champagne. That was a whole lot of fun, even though I had to crawl across the parking lot. Other issues with this approach, how reliable is the information that you're getting? Okay. Again, it's one thing if you're dealing with public companies. They have to file with the SEC. The financials are audited. And so generally put pretty high level of reliance upon those numbers. All right. Much more of a problem if you're dealing with privates. Let's see. How do you handle making those adjustments between your subject company and your comp? That's highly subjective and judgmental. Okay. You have to develop a feel for that over time with a little bit of experience. And then, as I mentioned before, differences in the rights and preferences between different classes of securities. Okay. This is personal opinion. Okay. So I have no idea how the investors in the Snap IPO let themselves buy those shares. It makes absolutely no sense at all. Okay? I mean, think about it. Would you buy ownership shares in a company where you have no right to say anything? How much sense does that make? Okay. As I said before, the rights and preferences of founder shares or golden shares or special shares or, you know, things like that should have some impact on value, right? Now, that said, if you actually take a look at it, the data actually doesn't indicate that it makes a huge difference. I've looked at a number of studies over the years going back, I think, all the way to the early 70s. And the data actually shows that having votes versus not having any votes embedded in those shares, the difference in value is roughly 3%. Okay. Now, different studies will show you different results, but typically I use that as a guideline, 3 to 5%, something like that. But does that make a difference? Well, yeah, it does kind of. But apparently the investors don't think that it makes that much of a difference. And the only reason I can think of that investors would believe that is that the buyers believe that there is some coincident, that there's a unity of economic interests between the investors who hold non-voting shares and the controlling shareholders who do own the voting shares. I worked in an investment bank at one point in my career that was a partnership. And one of the conditions of being admitted to partnership in that firm was that once you became a partner, you had to sign over your partnership voting rights to the managing partner. Okay. It worked great while the market was good, but ultimately at the end of the day, right, there were some decisions made by the managing partner that weren't exactly the most prescient. It's like anything else in life. It's good when it's good. It's horrible when it's bad. That's the ideal, but that's kind of beyond the scope of this discussion right now. Okay. So I mentioned multiples, some commonly used multiples. Again, this is just a laundry list, but these are common multiples that investors, VCs, people who have analysts would take a look at in terms of the kinds of metrics that would be available to produce these valuation estimates. So I think my point of view is that typically what I'm most interested in, and again, this is me talking, what I'm most interested in and how I see companies typically is when I see a company, I see a big pile of cash sitting on my desk, hopefully. And so what I want to do with these multiples is get as close to the cash as I can. All right. So to me, the most useful types of multiples are ones that allow me to get close to cash. Okay. Obviously, market cap to free cash flow, that's pretty darn close because what I'm trying to get at is free cash flow. Unlevered free cash flow is perhaps as useful. And the reason why I say unlevered is that for those of you who are students in here, if you've taken corporate finance, go back to think about Madiglian and Miller, right? Does capital structure affect the value of a company? In theory, no. Okay. So I want to take a look at company valuation on an unlevered basis. And then I make adjustments later for leverage. For those of you who don't have a finance background, we just talked about some technical gibberish that you don't really need to worry about. Okay. The thing is, unlevered free cash flow may be things that are difficult to calculate based on available information. All right. Companies are more prone to do press releases or announce things like EBITDA. And for those of you who don't know, EBITDA stands for earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization. And EBIT is the same thing, only without the depreciation and amortization part. Okay. I personally like EBITDA because, again, it's pretty close to cash flow, and it's actually pretty close to unlevered cash flow, all right? Now, you'll find quite often with startup companies and with a lot of companies who aren't performing well that are publicly traded is that they may not even have positive EBITDA, right? So if they're losing money and they have negative EBITDA, does it really make sense to calculate a multiple off of it? No. Because you're never going to pay a negative value for a company's shares, right? It's like, Mr. IBM, give me your company and also give me $5 billion. It doesn't work that way. So the next thing you do is you keep moving up your income statement, okay? Trying to find a positive number. And if a company has revenues, then that's very top of the income statement. It has to be a positive number if they have any revenues at all. So you can take a look at enterprise value to revenue, okay? Some of the other valuation multiples, market cap to book value of equity, that was good way back in the day. I'm thinking like in the 30s and 40s, because those were in the early days of Wall Street. Those were the types of numbers that companies published. Okay. And those numbers are really, really easy, or should be really, really easy to get. Okay. And again, it gives you a good sense. It gives you a guideline, but you'll have to probably make some subjective adjustments to those numbers based on your judgment. Other multiples, other metrics, as I mentioned, may be appropriate depending on the specific industry, the availability of the information. All right. Like I said, with a lot of companies in the app space, it's going to be average monthly users or something like that. So what a typical market approach to valuation might look like is something like this. Okay. And I'm not going to get very, very deep into the numbers, but basically you have a couple of performance metrics. This was something that we did back in 2015. So we would look at it based on 2015 revenue and then forward looking into 2016. Okay. We calculate forward multiples because, again, the market is typically more worried about prospective growth and what's going to happen in the future than what's happened in the past. I'm a firm believer that the minute you put any numbers into a spreadsheet and you present projections to anybody, the minute those numbers go into the spreadsheet, one thing you know, they're wrong. Right? Okay. But the point is, as you said, you got to start somewhere. And the question is, how defensible are those projections? Everything else is just technique and process. Okay. There are some judgment calls in terms of if you're doing a discounted cash flow, which we'll get into, what's your discount rate, what's your eventual terminal growth rate, things like that. That's all judgment. We can do sensitivity analyses all around that. That's what Excel is built for. And we can do those all day, right? But it's garbage in, garbage out. It's black box. But if your projections are defensible, or at least you can come to some kind of basis for agreement with your audience, okay, then the rest of it should fall out. All right, so we take a look at these performance metrics that we projected. On this one, we happen to do it based on revenue multiples. We apply a certain range of multiples based on comps. There's a whole bunch of stuff behind this but we simply do the math across, come up with the range, and then keeping in mind that this market approach is based on comparable public companies that are trading minority interests, right, in the marketplace. So we're valuing this enterprise value range on a minority basis. So that's essentially the market approach. And if we were doing this based on transactions, then the value would be on a controlling interest basis. And then we'd have to make some adjustment to make an adjustment for a discount for lack of control to get down to a comparable like-for-like minority basis valuation. Or we could apply a control premium to this to get to a control value, depending on the purpose of doing our valuation. So the income approach, all right? Personally, this is my favorite. And I know, how geeky is it for me, for someone to have a favorite method of doing valuations, right? Anyway, so as I said, I see companies, I envisage a big pile of cash. I get all warm just thinking about that. Income approach is what we call an intrinsic value, going way back to my example of thinking about your house. Okay. This is akin to if you owned a house and you're going to rent it out. The value of that house to you as the owner is what? The present value of all of the rent payments that your tenant is going to be paying you. Okay. That's it. Simple in concept, a little bit more tricky in execution. As you may have gathered by now, the point of this is to project cash flows into the future that the asset or the company is expected to generate. The value is going to be based on the net present value of these future cash flows. And then the discount rate, again, for those of you who have some background in finance, the discount rate is going to be based on the weighted average cost of capital. And the weighted average cost of capital, I don't know whether we put it in here, but it's essentially what it costs for the entrepreneur to secure the capital that is going to be required to build out this company and execute the business plan. All right. And when I say capital, I'm including both equity and debt. Okay. Cost of debt is pretty easy to figure out based on a company's borrowing rate. You make some allowances for a company's ability to borrow. Most entrepreneurs, most early stage startup companies, you can just assume that the amount of debt that they're going to be able to borrow is zero. There just isn't enough history there unless you're willing to personally guarantee, which I would not recommend. But if you're willing to personally guarantee the loan, then your lender may lend it to you on the basis of your personal guarantee. And the other issue with that is unless you already have a whole lot of money, you're not going to be able to borrow enough really to build out a company. And if you had that much money to start with, then why would you borrow in the first place? The other component of weighted average cost of capital is what's it going to cost for you to, or what do you need to pay to your equity investors in order to get them to invest? And generally speaking, because of the difference in the order in which they get paid off, if anything goes wrong, the cost of equity is almost always, I hesitate to throw the term almost in there, but almost always higher than the cost of debt. Okay, just because the equity investors face more risk. Okay, valuation of IP, again, typically we wouldn't do it unless it was in a purchase price allocation similar to customer list. However, I have done a couple of projects where we specifically valued some IP, some technology that was being developed for a variety of purposes, not transactional per se, okay? But you can use the same type of techniques that we're talking about here to value the IP. How much would it cost you to replicate it? How much do you already have invested in it? Are there any similar technologies or IP or something similar out there that has either been licensed or sold? Okay, market approach. How much cash flow can you derive from it, from the ultimate use or licensing out of that IP? Income approach. The techniques aren't different. And again, go back to focusing on fundamentals. All right, I hate to say this because it makes me sound really, really bad. Go back to focusing on a big pile of cash. That's what you want. All right, so I don't really get into a whole lot of details about the cost of equity here, but there's a whole lot of academic work that's been done, studies on cost of equity. All the students here will probably know capital asset pricing model. I'm sure a lot of other people here will have heard the term also. You learn it in school, and it's stuff that I'm still using 30, 40 years later. So pay attention. All right. Then one thing to keep in mind, and as you know, a company is legally, it's a legal entity, right? It's a person, effectively. But it doesn't have a real end. Companies go on forever. And so when you do projections, you extend out your projection for a certain number of years, and that's called your explicit projection period. Well, to recognize that a company goes on forever, you need to, in theory, you would need to extend those projections out forever, which is just too much of a pain in the neck to do. And quite frankly, after a certain number of years, how much credence do you put in those numbers anyway? Well, okay, so one of the things that we do as an approximation is we develop explicit projections over the explicit period, and then we calculate what's called a residual value or a terminal value, okay? And I use the term terminal value very loosely. It doesn't imply that the company's coming to an end. It's just the projections have come to an end, and that value represents everything else that comes after that. There are a couple ways that we can do that. There's something called a Gordon growth model or capitalization model, which I could go through the mathematical derivation, but you guys would probably revolt. Suffice it to say that it's an estimation. We could also apply guideline company multiples from our market approach, very similar to the market approach. We can just apply a terminal multiple to the financial metrics from our last explicit projected year. All right. And that will serve as an approximation for everything that comes after the explicit projection period. And oh, by the way, I've made it sound like that's a rather trivial number, but it's not. All right. If you take a look at the analysis that I've done in my career, for most early stage company, terminal value typically represents the largest component by a significant amount. It represents the largest component of the value of a company. And even if you take a look at companies in more traditional industries that have gone through like a leveraged buyout or private equity transaction, even for those companies, typically the terminal value represents the largest component of value. And just thinking through the companies, the projects that I'm working on now, generally speaking, I would say that depending on how far out we extended the explicit projections, I'm looking at terminal value representing somewhere between 60 and 80% of the value of the company, even though that's not expected to happen until 10, 15 years from now. I've actually seen, and I've actually worked on valuing companies where terminal value represented more than 100% of the value of the company. The explicit projection period was actually negative. Okay? That happens. So the retention part's easy because that just means you have less turnover and your HR costs is going to be a little bit less, right? And that has a direct impact on cash. You don't have to pay additional costs to replace people, to train people, to recruit people. So if you're good at retaining your employees, that helps to improve your margins over time. Okay, so that part's easy. Having the right specific developer or the right specific biz dev person or the right specific salesperson or whatever, that's a little bit harder to represent. And I don't think that there's a really, really good way to do it in terms of doing the valuation other than maybe perhaps taking a look at something like key man insurance policy, something like that. And one would have to pay in order to protect that particular asset. Unfortunately, that's part of the shortcomings of all of these valuation methodologies. I would love to have been able to do, for example, pull data from all of the acquihire transactions when, you know, Facebook paid like $11 billion for two guys in a garage and trying to figure out what kind of a premium would have been generated by that. But the data is just not available, right? Because it's a private company. It was so small that it was not material to Facebook's operations or any big acquirer's operations from a financial metric perspective. So disclosure is typically very poor in those types of transactions. So market size, market opportunity. Do you have a credible plan to access that opportunity? What's the team that you have either built or have commitments to build in order to execute on the plan? How reasonable is your plan? A lot of that comes down to the team. An aphorism I've often heard is that VCs don't necessarily bet on the horse, they bet on the jockey. So the income approach, pros and cons, as again mentioned before, it represents intrinsic value, gets at the heart of what the company is supposed to do. It provides an objective framework. And this is the one area where we can talk about objectiveness in a sea of subjectivity. It provides a framework to assess the opportunity and the risk of those opportunities. Okay? And because you're really using a lattice of projections to do this, it's flexible. I mean, the reality is, if I wanted to, I could take an income approach or discounted cash flow model, and I can run Monte Carlo simulations across all of the variables. I don't necessarily know how much good that really does me in a lot of instances, but I could do it if I wanted to. There are, however, despite my fondness for the methodology, there are some downsides or there's some problems with it. It's really, really sensitive to certain assumptions, specifically discount rate and terminal value. I think those are the key ones. But it's also sensitive to the projections, base projections. What are your margin assumptions? What are your growth assumptions? There's an unbalanced, as I mentioned before, an unbalanced distribution of value between the explicit and the terminal value periods. Okay. And how realistic are the projections? So this is a typical discounted cash flow type of analysis. One convention that we use in our work is all the numbers that you see in blue, those are hard codes. Okay. And those are simply assumptions. And the numbers that are in black are calculations or the calculations of certain drivers. Okay, but you can see that there are a lot of hard codes, particularly in the operating expenses. The fact is that I could gray out that entire section and really wouldn't impact the forecast all that much. What I'm really worried about is my total expenses and my EBITDA and my cash flow number. So in this instance, we start in 2015, we project out to 2024. That's our explicit projection period. And the only reason why we had to go out that far is take a look at the projections. The first growth number isn't really apples to apples because there's a calculation in there that compares 1 month of 2015 to 12 months of 2016. So that's not a really valid comparison. But even from 2016 to 2017, we're projecting that we're growing at 33% a year. That's a pretty huge growth rate for this particular market. And so we had to ramp that down to something that approaches as the long-term rate of inflation, which we assume at 3%. And again, it's not necessarily because we're thinking that we're going to lose market share or the market's shrinking. It's just that mathematically, as our revenue number gets bigger, it gets harder to grow that by the same amount. Just a couple of quick points, and this is stuff that I pulled from PitchBook, updated through the first quarter. Financing environment through the first quarter of 2017 has not been great. Now, there are a couple of reasons maybe why there was a downturn in financing and in actual deals getting done through 2016, and why the several elements in the market believe that it's kind of being poised for a comeback in 2017. The reality is that 2016, a lot of the VCs were on the road trying to raise new funds. That fundraising has already happened. And a lot of people believe that now that the VCs have this new dry powder ready to be invested, they're getting pressured to actually invest, and they're gearing up. They're starting to analyze more companies. And so the potential for the environment improving, people are actually kind of optimistic about it for the rest of 2017. The issue, though, is if you take a look at it for, I think, most of the audience in this room, is that if you take a look, the environment for angel and seed investors is probably the worst performing of the VC marketplace. So the idea is make sure you get your stories together. Yeah, make sure you have your story straight and have all the elements of valuation to support the overall thesis that you're trying to present to investors. And I guess the moral of the story, basically, yes, valuation is important, but it's only part of a greater overall theme that you're trying to present to investors. And you just have to make sure that all the elements are consistent. Then I just wanted to bring up, really, literally, this was something I saw published by Harvard Business Review last week. And so I really haven't had a chance to kind of integrate it into the presentation. But think about how you as an entrepreneur present your opportunity. Okay, there was some research done recently on, this was actually presented in terms of gender bias. VC investors, regardless of whether they were men or women, tend to ask male entrepreneurs and female entrepreneurs different questions. Okay, and from a different perspective, the male entrepreneurs typically get asked questions which are a little bit more promotional, whereas female entrepreneurs get asked questions which are a little bit more what the academics term preventative in scope. Okay, an example would be VCs would ask a male entrepreneur, what's your strategy for increasing your revenue growth? Whereas the female entrepreneurs would more typically get asked a question like, well, how do you prevent customer loss? Okay, and it's actually, they found that this is an unconscious bias. Even female VCs do the exact same thing, overwhelmingly, okay, for whatever reason. But the upside of that is that they also found that typically you'll have a better chance of securing financing regardless of what question you're asked to respond with a promotional type answer. So if you as a female, or even if you're a male entrepreneur, you get asked, well, how are you going to prevent customer loss? Couch your response in terms of, well, we're going to do this, but in order to execute on our customer growth or market growth or revenue growth strategy. And they found that entrepreneurs that did that, regardless of their gender, tended to raise more money than their counterparts. One last story. There's a professor at NYU named Aswath Damodaran, who is pretty famous in business valuation circles. He did an analysis a few years ago on Uber, trying to do an independent valuation of Uber. Okay, let's not get into the whole Uber thing right now, but this was when the press was talking about Uber being a $50, $60 billion company. Okay, and based on his analysis and his own research, right, he came up with the value of maybe a couple of billion dollars. And that was the best that he could do based on certain relatively benign assumptions. He didn't really understand the market opportunity or the interpretation of the market opportunity. Then just by happenstance, he ran into Bill Gurley, okay, who sits on Uber's board. And they kind of had a talk, and Gurley explained to Damodaran certain elements of Uber's strategy and the market segments and the addressable markets that they were trying to attack and how they were going to get there. And he went back and revised his independent valuation, and the valuation numbers started going up. Okay, I think initially hit like $14 billion, and then he had another chat with Gurley, did some additional research on his own, observed what was happening in the marketplace, redid his numbers. That ran up to about 20. And ultimately, he wound up at somewhere between 28 and 30. Still a lot less than what the press was talking about. But a good chunk of what the press was talking about was the difference between what pre- and post-money valuation stuff that we talked about and lack of recognition of the value of the additional rights that the preferred shareholders that invested in that $60 billion round had versus the common. Okay, so again, the valuation techniques provides a framework, but it's a framework to tell the bigger overall story. And you need to make sure that those things are consistent.